Maybe a couple of seconds and I will.
Tēnā koutou, I'm Selwyn Manning and welcome to A View From Afar. And today we are joined by political scientist and former Pentagon analyst Paul Buchanan. And we will discuss this week's revelations by Paula Penfold and the Stuff Circuit team that a New Zealand tech company with New Zealand government investment has been in business with iFlyTech, a Chinese company alleged to be involved with surveillance of China's oppressed Uyghur people. Does this example underscore the perils facing New Zealand companies and others from other countries that enter into joint ventures with Chinese interests in the surveillance and state sector? And should New Zealand government front up and provide answers as to how it came to invest in the New Zealand company that got into business with iFlyTech? Also, halfway through this program, we will discuss the latest disturbing events occurring in Myanmar. What's caused the Myanmar military to once again overthrow a government and establish deadly totalitarian rule? But before we kick off this week's program, here's an invitation to those of you who are joining us live. If you are joining us via Facebook, Twitter, or YouTube, do feel free to make comments. And if you do, we'll be able to include your interaction in this debate. So, let's cross to Paul, who is waiting for us online. Good afternoon, Paul.
How am I? How are you doing, Selwyn?
Not too bad, Paul. Thanks again for your company. Now, the situation with respect to ethical investment, it's been brought to light once again by the Stuff Circuit investigative team, particularly presented by Paula Penfold. And it's, as I said in the introduction, it is challenging, really, New Zealand and where, and particularly in the tech space, where we are sitting relating to this being involved with a totalitarian type of oppression that is occurring and widely reported inside provinces in China, and the Uyghur people are right in focus with this. Paul, how do you read the situation? I know that you've watched the documentary by Paula Penfold as well. And what do you make of this whole situation here?
Well, so things seem to be coming to a head because the contradictions now between New Zealand's diplomatic orientation and its economic orientation when it comes to trade of all sorts are now increasingly contradictory. And so it's been interesting to see the convergence of several investigative streams. I mean, this is the latest one. It's absolutely damning. But remember, you and I have talked now in the past few weeks about the New Zealand, Air New Zealand, working for the Saudi Navy. We've talked about dozens of New Zealand suppliers to the military-industrial complex of various countries around the world, including some with less than savory reputations. And so what it shows you is that the import-export regime, at least in the security field, and let's face it, mass surveillance is security, is really porous, if not designed, to be so than because technologies have simply outstripped what could well have been an archaic regulatory regime way back when. I will say by way of backdrop that the contradiction that I just mentioned stems from the decision made 30 years ago to reorient in New Zealand foreign policy towards trade with non-traditional partners, which, you know, in principle is very good. But what happened was over the years, and particularly under the national government installed in 2008, there was a purge of traditional diplomats. Remember, New Zealand used to be very well known for its expertise in non-proliferation, you know, the various conventions on chemical weapons and that sort of stuff. We were world leaders. Those diplomats, as they moved into their 50s, were purged. You know, they're either given golden handshakes or simply told to go. And they were replaced by what I will unkindly call trade zealots.
Yeah,
trade's sake.
We saw the same thing. 2008 through, once again, you know, the tensions between the diplomatic corps and the foreign affairs ministry and also the trade wing. And we saw a move away from aid in the Pacific and aid overseas and other regions to a trade for aid type ethos that the national-led government of the early 2010 and onwards took. So I just wanted to just place that in the situation here so that some of the viewers overseas could see that.
Yeah, no, it's good to have the elaboration. You know, the deal is this, you know, each country has to develop its own foreign policy according to its domestic political requirements, its sense of ethics. I mean, there's a lot that goes into the mix. And that's crystallized in bureaucratic appointments within the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and in this case, trade. Now, having a balance between trade zealots and traditional diplomats with expertise and non-proliferation and those sort of things, what it does is the in-house discussion would address things like the Uyghurs. You know, one side would say, hey, you know, we're moving into an increasingly cozy relationship with Chinese companies that serve the interests of the Chinese state in the security field. And those interests are sort of inimical to our value system. So, you know, let's have a rethink. That's not is what is happening anymore.
We've seen a change in the New Zealand government since 2017 to the Jacinda Ardern-led government. There was a lot of emphasis on rebuilding New Zealand foreign affairs and trade and obviously developing up the deficits that it had in the diplomatic side of it, if you want to put it in that way. Are you seeing any evidence of that in real terms from the policy, or are we seeing still that the trade zealots, as you're defining them, are still perhaps the dominant factor or faction and also still in its ascendancy?
Well, they're no longer ascendant, but they're still the dominant faction. Remember, a lot of the appointees from 10 years ago or more were in their 30s, so they're in their prime, these trade zealots. But under the Labor government, we are seeing a bit of a rollback. The trouble is this, Selwyn. We're far down the pike of our engagement with the Chinese and some other unpleasant regimes. And this is my thought on it. It's sort of what you might call the drug pusher engagement. I know it sounds bad, but it is bad. Small New Zealand firms, let's say tech firms, they don't have the capital to grow into global players. And so the Chinese will approach them. You know, a Chinese firm will identify some startup company that has been started, incidentally, with seed money from the New Zealand government. And they'll say to them, look, we will capitalize you 100 times what your value is now. All we need is half ownership. All we need is some seats on your board. All we need is access to your technologies and what have you, and you will grow. And they do grow.
They provide the market with that, the market access, all the facilitations within China. I'm wondering too, Paul, is this seems to be most evident within the tech sector with respect to its trade relationships and joint venture relationships with Chinese entities. Outside of that, you know, the transfer of two-way trade and ordinary goods, manufactured products from China, et cetera, et cetera, doesn't seem to come into the scope of concerns here, largely. So is this the area where the government needs to focus and scope its concerns down into, meaning the trade areas, the IT sectors, and then certainly where they interact with companies that are in the surveillance and into the whole network or the oppressive chain, perhaps, of how we could determine it? We'll come to just having a look at what Paula Penfold and that team have put out in a moment. But let's address those issues first, Paul.
You've identified it very well. This problem is a two-way street. It's about Chinese, in the first instance, penetration of New Zealand markets, let's say the dairy market, and then New Zealand exporters of technology and other things connecting with unsavory regimes. The more political sensitive issue is, in fact, the Chinese presence in the New Zealand domestic market. Why? Because that can become a voting issue every election year. Too many foreigners taking over, and the racists come out and the xenophobes come out and what have you. So that's a political hot potato. However, given the licensing regime, given the the regulatory regime for exporters, the partnership of New Zealand high tech firms with, and again, I don't want to bash the Chinese. We've been talking about Rocket Lab and the U.S. military. These high-tech exporters, as you will, they receive far less scrutiny, and it's not as politically sensitive an issue for the domestic electorate. So what happens is you go from being a logistics supplier to a relatively benign thing, let's say voice recognition technologies for these little home assistants, to cooperating with Chinese firms that are engaged in heinous activities against the weaker, including mass surveillance, retinal scans, I mean, you name it, the most intrusive thing. Now, you may say, as a realist, well, you know, the business of business is business. And so moralizing about what we can and cannot do, that's for, you know, that's Pollyannish. No, but the problem here is that we're a liberal democracy that publicly says that we champion human rights and the rule of law and that sort of thing. So we are violating our own foreign policy principles when we allow these companies to engage freely. Now,
the New Zealand government has been signaling this transition to business trade on an ethical basis. I think that's fairly well asserted now. So we've even seen the new Minister of Foreign Affairs, Nanaia Mahuta, for example, talking about fair trade, et cetera, et cetera. Although they're not showing up on this particular issue relating to the Uyghurs issues that Stuff Circuit has put into scope. But Paul, I'd just like to pick up at this point and go to what the introduction to the documentary that Paula Penfold and her team have done. I'll just bring it up on screen here. And start that going here. So, one moment.
If you imagine a hell that you know, the real situation in Xinjiang is 100 times worse than that.
A dystopian surveillance state where every interaction can be watched, every conversation heard.
There is no freedom for Uyghur people.
Government workers sent to live in people's homes to monitor them.
It's not like proper life you want to have.
There's the human rights abuse in plain sight, and then there's the hidden.
I lost contact with my family 3 years back.
People rounded up and detained in internment camps. First-hand reports of systematic rape, torture, forced labour, forced sterilisation.
If I do contact him, then he may be back to the concentration camp again, so I just don't want to take that risk.
In 2018, the US State Department put the number of detentions at possibly more than 2 million. And now the US and others have begun calling it genocide.
So, Paul, We can see what is happening there. That's the brief introduction, and I would encourage viewers and our audience to check out the Stuff Circuit documentary on this issue. It's called Deleted. But Paul, so when we are confronted with what is, there is an evidence base to what is going on with the Uyghur people at the hands of the more oppressive side of the People's Republic of China's regime there. And we're talking, many are claiming and stating it as genocide because of the stacking numbers of deaths, and we've got to underscore that reportage of this is extremely difficult. What do you believe the New Zealand government ought to do when it knows that it has been perhaps, you know, willing to invest in New Zealand companies that are then joining in and in some ways complicit in what is going on over in China with the Uyghur people because of the technology and the advancements and the intellectual property they are providing? What should the New Zealand government do when it is seen and it's been reported and revealed that it has been involved quite deeply on this and knowing what has been going on over in China?
Well, what it should do and what it can do are two very different things. And they're two very different things for two reasons. The first one is that we're a minnow dealing with a whale when it comes to the Chinese economy and the Chinese influence in our lives, where they are our biggest trade partner. If they get irritated by some sanctimonious stance that we choose, or something pragmatic, like telling the tech companies they're going to have to back off with these partnerships, the punishment meted out to us will be disproportionate to any offense that we've committed. And the Chinese have a track record of this, a track record with not just in Australia, but with regards to, for example, the Norwegians. I forget exactly what the Norwegians did that annoyed them, but there were punitive economic sanctions imposed on them for having the temerity to challenge Chinese power. The second reason is that we are heavily influenced domestically in our politics, but also our corporate structure, by Chinese interests. So inside of New Zealand, the will to confront the Chinese over human rights issues, particularly in the business class, is not as strong as, you know, you and I might hope it to be. I mean, academics, that sort of crowd who don't control money, sure, they're up in arms about the genocide on the Uyghur, and I do use that term because it's clear now that's exactly what it is, or ethnic cleansing, if you want to use another phrase. But the hard fact is that New Zealand is extremely dependent on Chinese trade, and it's extremely influenced by Chinese interests at home. So it's very unlikely that the government is going to move strongly to start imposing restrictions that could backfire. And Selwyn, just to make the larger point, this is more evidence of how the road to hell is paved with good intentions. United States under the Obama regime believed that by engaging China economically in a free trade regime, by having the United States invite China to the World Trade Organization, that somehow by osmosis, the Chinese would begin to democratize, that they would become fair players on the world stage, that they would somehow behave more Western, that, you know, that they would accept Western values.
So we see during the Trump administration years, and the vacuum that's created, and China has actually morphed into quite a different beast. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just that the assumption here again, and one again, I think about foreign policy and the basis for it. So there was a theoretical assumption rooted in something known as modernization theory, that if you gave them more free market capitalism, you engaged them with liberal democracies around the world. The Chinese and other authoritarians, again, I don't want to make this just about China, would somehow pass those influences into their political system. A new middle class would embrace democracy, all those sort of things. Had these theoreticians here at home, as well as in the United States, read their history a little better, particularly with regards to Latin America, they would know that bringing more capitalism to a country that hasn't had it does not necessarily bring democracy whatsoever. In fact, it tends to reinforce authoritarianism if that authoritarianism is institutionalized.
Okay,
and
Paul,
that's exactly what happened with regards to China. So now we're facing the consequences of having engaged the Chinese, becoming dependent on them, and now trying to tell them that they need to ascribe to our values or we're going to do, and at that point, the question mark emerged.
What I want to do is to revisit that that issue about New Zealand's a small player, it's got a small voice, it's a minnow in this type of thing. And we'll just bring to attention here that we're not alone in this, and human rights is an ideal, and what can be spoken of in those areas sometimes transcends the size of one's GDP and the population. But some of our security partners, of which we in previous episodes have discussed the perils and the difficulties of aligning foreign policy and diplomacy to the Five Eyes security networks. So that's something that we can just park. But if we look at what the United States has been doing with respect to the Uyghur people, just bringing up on screen there, we've got McGovern, Smith and colleagues reintroduced the bipartisan Uyghur Forced Labour Prevention Act. That's in the House of Representatives in the United States. So that it seems for maybe for their own national security, trade, etc. reasons, the United States is making a move on it. But so is Britain, so is Canada, so is Australia. Those are four members of the Five Eyes network, of which New Zealand is a part of. One would expect that New Zealand, on its strong human rights principles, is not voicing things alone. It can stand apart from those, but it can stand and sing the same chorus, if you like, albeit from its independent base. I'm not seeing a lot of that apart from 2 years ago, Jacinda Ardern, on a face-to-face bilateral meeting with the leadership of the People's Republic of China, addressed face-to-face the issue of the Uyghur people. But since then, I haven't seen a lot of movement from the New Zealand government. Do you think, I'll put it again to you, do you think that the environment is right now for New Zealand to speak stronger on this, in keeping perhaps with some of the strong measures that our partners have already done?
I believe that they have to say something. Now, the trouble is, on the one hand, the Chinese have overextended themselves, and they've picked many fights now with an assortment of nations, but pretty much all of the liberal democratic community one way or another. So we have diplomatic cover if we begin to criticize the Chinese on their human rights record. Of course, they will bite back at us, and that's where the concern is. Our diplomatic cover is great to, you know, use the Five Eyes, use the community of liberal democracies as the forum in which we present our grievances to the Chinese. But we don't have economic cover. I mean, the U.S. is a big place. Even the Australians can resist a little bit, although they've been punished by the Chinese.
The United States, Britain, and Canada are not going to come to our aid and pay our bills.
You got it. See, that's it. The Five Eyes is an intelligence network. It does not extend to helping us out when our exports start rotting on Chinese docks. Mm. And there again, we get back to the dichotomy between the diplomatic and the economic. And in New Zealand now, I mean, I'm sincere when I tell you this, the business of New Zealand is business, not human rights. I mean, I hate to be so cynical, but the business class are not as enamored of, again, these airy-fairy ideals when there's hard, cold cash to be made. And I think that, you know, you and I straddle the fence. We understand business logics, but we're rooted in this fundamental principle known as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And so we can say, hey, the hard fact is you're going to have to give up a little bit of profit in order to make the point that the Chinese cannot profit from slave labor amongst the Uyghurs. And again, slave labor that in some instances may be directly tied to New Zealand, through these various companies that are doing business with the Chinese. That's going to be a hard sell politically. You know, I think our parliament, if we were to introduce a bill that was like the one introduced in Congress, I'd be really interested to see how the parties vote, because I'm telling you, I think both major parties may split internally over which way to go. Sure, the Greens will vote in favor of human rights, and good on them. Everybody else, I'm not so sure, because let's face it, their pockets are lined by, not completely, but are lined in some measure by sponsors that are associated with Chinese interests.
Yeah, well put. Now, we've got a comment that's come in from Kevin Hester here, and I'll just address that. And Kevin says, I know it will never happen, but what does Paul think about Aotearoa New Zealand following a policy of neutrality to remove ourselves from being aligned to any of the superpowers?
Well, I think it it briefly worked after the non-nuclear declaration. And so I think that had we stuck to that line, not necessarily going down the trade route that we did, because I think we were inevitably going to find problems with some of our new trading partners, but we had to do it. The hard fact is after 9/11, New Zealand quietly chose a side. And this was before the Chinese became a so-called threat. And they chose a side. They chose to reestablish their security ties to the United States in particular, but the United States-led security alliance, which is both military as well as in terms of intelligence. And that's where we are today. Kevin may remember, because I've said it publicly before, you know, trying to get out of Five Eyes is like trying to get out of the mafia. I mean, once you're in, you think about all the proprietary secrets, the technologies. Yeah. It's not an easy thing to do. So he's absolutely right. The status quo of us being aligned security-wise with the so-called West, but more importantly, the Anglophone countries, is here to stay for the foreseeable future. And any move to towards independence will result in punitive sanctions from the other side. You know, we're worried right now about the leverage that the Chinese has on us economically. Think of the leverage that the United States and its Five Eyes partners have on us in terms of security. We won't get intelligence flows. I mean, you know, all sorts of bad things can happen. You know, I'm a big believer in plebiscites and referenda. One of the things that I love about New Zealand politics, other than, you know, MMP and that sort of thing, is you, from time to time we have referenda on big issues. Doesn't always work out the way I want, but I think it would be very interesting, given the generational and demographic changes occurring in New Zealand as we speak, to have a referenda about non-alignment. You know, do we want to go one way or the other? Do we want to straddle that barbed wire fence? Or are we willing to compromise our material standards of living and to some extent our security in order to live truly free of the associations and the baggage that these linkages bring to us?
It's a fair comment, Paul. We'll just take a quick break to thank our sponsors, and also we'll come back and we're going to discuss Myanmar. Paul, so Myanmar, there's been problems going back many decades in Myanmar, clearly. And what we are seeing now is once again returning a country in transition toward what? Military rule, dictatorship. But it, first off, Paul, here is a clip that's coming through from Al Jazeera. And this is relating to China's crackdown after China-backed factories were set ablaze in Myanmar.
The medical student was caught in the crackdown by security forces on the outskirts of Yangon.
We medical doctors initiated the civil disobedience movement from an early time. Now, a life has been sacrificed, so I'm sure we as the medical community will not step back from the fight. We will fight until the end.
While security forces continued their crackdown, the junta also imposed martial law in six nearby townships of Yangon. prompting thousands to flee the industrial zone of Huai Taiya, the location of Chinese factories that were torched on Sunday, home to many migrant workers from across Myanmar. It's still unclear who started the fires.
Now, Paul, what we're seeing there is China spoke very persuasively to the military leadership in the last few days, post China's assets, its people coming under, some would say, attack inside Myanmar. It has been, from what I can see around the diplomatic kind of exchanges, China has not spoken out against the military actually asserting itself and taking steps toward total rule in Myanmar, but more to try and protect its own assets, its own factories, its own labour force that's inside the country. What has caused this in Myanmar, the latest expression of this, Paul? What relationships will be affected by this, and where is it tracking toward? Is that totalitarian military rule in Myanmar?
No, I don't, but I'll say this. I'm very thankful that I have a background in regime transition analysis. And the reason I say that is because the political system of Myanmar in the 2010s was determined by the 2008 constitution, which, among other things, guaranteed 25% of the lower and upper houses of parliament to the military, and one-third of all state legislatures and governments also to the military, military appointees, active duty. And in the 2015 elections, the National League for Democracy, led by Aung San Suu Kyi, I'm going to call her Suu Kyi from now on, won a supermajority of 63%, and they've been ruling, they ruled up until last year. Last year in November, they won 83% of the parliamentary seats. Now, the trouble there is that the veto power exercised by the military via its appointees is effectively put in check. And not only is that a corporate threat to the military's veto power over what the civilian government can do, but then Suu Kyi and her political allies attempted to engage in constitutional reforms that would further diminish the military presence in political life. Now, to be clear.
So the elites within the military started to get sensitive to this move. They see it as a move against them, pushing them out of the way, aligning with more democratically aligned countries, particularly within the ASEAN areas. But also we know that the United States, through the US Treasury, going back 10 years, has been involving itself with a democratically elected government in Myanmar by capacity building, training people up. I know a person that was involved in doing exactly that on behalf of the US and New Zealand person in the taxation areas, like a tax commissioner type of position, getting them up to speed, if you like, so that they're repositioning and realigning. Has all of that gone?
It could well be. I mean, we have to be very clear here. The politics of Myanmar are driven by ethno-religious and personality orientations. This is not about democracy, Selwyn. This is a quarrel amongst elite about the spoils. And the spoils are overseas investors coming in, and the hands of both the civilian elites and the military elites are out for a percentage of this expanding pie. And that's the trouble here, is that as the civilians attempt to grow their power vis-a-vis the military elite are the guys with the guns, and they can see that they're going to be hurt financially if this continues. And process of transition usually take 10 years or more, but we have to remember a very simple adage. They're all about two steps forward, one step back. What we're seeing in Myanmar today is a step back. I think the military has reckoned that it will survive this, that it can kill any number of people, in part because the divisions in the country don't allow for a full national protest movement. You know, a lot of these protests we're seeing are very, again, ethno-religious driven or personality cult driven. The key here, though, is the foreign interlocutors. The biggest investors in Myanmar are China and Singapore. Japan is a major investor. And they, quite frankly, are not interested in democratic accountability or transparency. They're interested in stability and certainty. And they're banking on the fact that the military will have the power to impose the stability of silence. Get all these fractious people off the street, cut a new deal with the elite and say, okay, you see what happens when you overstep the mark with that talk about constitutional reform. And by the way, in the middle of all this is the complicity of the civilian elite with the genocide of the Rohingya. The military did the killing, but that military elite comes from the same ethno-religious and class background as the civilian elites. And the civilian elites did more than wink and nod about this genocide. Let's just say that they don't like the Rohingya either. And so it's like a murderer's convention. These guys do the actual killing. The other guys look the other way and put up a nice facade for Western countries who are offering developmental aid and say, oh, we're better than those guys over there. And they try to use it as leverage on the military, not to protect the Rohingya, but to expand their interests, corporate interests, vis-a-vis the military itself. It was bound to end in disaster. It was fraught from the get-go. And now we're seeing the results of it. So my, you know, I'm not big on predictions, but the military has said that there needs to be a new constitution written.
And for 1 year. 1 year, they're saying 1 year, basically, to get what they want.
Exactly. So that's what they're going to do. They're going to negotiate the terms of next year's transition back to democracy, such as it is. We may not see the same civilian players, or for that matter, some of the military players, but I can guarantee you this. Unless there is a massive popular revolt, unless the Chinese, the Singaporeans, the Japanese withdraw their support for the military in this contest, then what we'll see down the road is a reassertion of what is known as the guarded democracy, a democracy where military has the ultimate veto power over civilian decision makings. And there's a precedent for this. Fiji today is a guarded democracy engineered out of the authoritarian regime that preceded it. Chile, after 1990, was a guarded democracy for nearly 15 years. South Korea was a guarded democracy in the late 70s and early 1980s. So military authoritarians have studied their history, and they know if they can just outweigh human rights concerns, if they have big actors as quiet supporters of their initiatives, then they can suppress with impunity and no one's going to come and challenge them on their abuses.
And that, I guess your pitching would satisfy the ASEAN nations, the members of the ASEAN group, APEC, the economic fraternity there within Asia Pacific, because it would be edging back to business as usual.
Correct. Correct. And let's be honest, the catch-all for dictators and placed in this position, and let's be very clear, the military has not only the upper hand, they have both upper hands in this particular contest, is if the Myanmar authorities start talking about foreign interference in their internal affairs, you're going to see ASEAN, well, pretty much everybody, back off in a hurry, because that's the last refuge of scoundrels. And again, the Chinese are heavily invested. The Singaporeans, I won't talk about the military connection between Singapore and the Myanmar military, but there are big players involved in Myanmar that go beyond the Burmese themselves. So I see this situation resolving on military favorable terms. And we'll go back to something akin to 2014, 2015, before civilian politicians got too ambitious with their projects to the point that they provoked the military. I'm not saying the military is justified at all in what they have done, but seeing how that constitution was set up and seeing the warnings the military was giving over the years that they shouldn't press their luck, I think it was both naive and somewhat reckless after the November election for the civilian, you know, the NLD, NLP members to say they were going to revise the constitution to strip the military of some of its powers. Bad idea.
Okay, Paul, thank you for your company today. As we end the program and just bring in, Kevin Hester has made a comment there, and he's referring back to your response relating to Five Eyes. And Kevin says, trying to get out of the Five Eyes, and he's quoting you here, Paul, trying to get out of the Five Eyes is like trying to get out of the mob. He says, that's genius response, and thanks for posing that question for me. For answering that question for him. So on that point, thank you for you for joining us once again this week. We'll be back this time next week on Thursday around midday New Zealand time, which equates to around about 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time in the United States. So thank you again for your attendance, and we look forward to you returning back next week. Until then, take care. Goodbye.